Climate change has made a lot of news so far this year. In March, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, warned of the impact climate change can have on global food supply, human security, and the world's economies. In May, federal agencies released their biggest yet assessment of climate threats here in the U.S. Last month, the EPA imposed limits on greenhouse gases from existing power plants. Today, we hear the previous 2 months were both record breakers when it came to high global temperatures. Add it all up, our guest says we are currently failing in the battle against climate change. With us now is Dale Jamieson. He is Director of Environmental Studies at New York University, formerly associated with the National Center for Atmospheric Research. His new book is Reason in a Dark Time: Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. Dale, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
So past tense, you write, failed. It's already failed. Make the case that we are already on the downslope.
Well, we have already acted in such a way as to commit the planet to more than 1,000 years of warming. Our children, our grandchildren, and their grandchildren will live in a very different world than the one in which we grew up.
Why did we fail? What was it about our thoughts and our actions that led to this?
Well, the interesting thing about climate change is that I have a friend, an economist friend, who once said if you wanted to design a pill that would put an end to humanity, it would have many of the qualities of climate change. It's a problem that's long-term. It's a problem whose effects are very indirect, very dissociated from the causes. Evolution didn't build us to respond to the buildup of colorless, odorless gases in the atmosphere. It's a really difficult problem. And then you layer on top of that the dysfunctions of our political system, the problem in our short-term economic thinking, the fact that our ethical and moral systems are really about what one person does to another person at present tense. It's just not a problem that we're geared up to solve. And so we've got to learn how to solve these kinds of problems, because these are the kinds of problems that we're going to see more and more in population-dense, high-technology societies.
And this is, in many ways, as you say, an ethical problem. How do we recalibrate our ethics from worrying about direct harm I do someone to being a big part of a big complicated system of doing harm to people down the road?
Well, that's obviously a question for which there's no simple answer and no short-run answer. It's one that's going to require a kind of moral revolution in our thinking. But we're going to have to get our arms around this problem even before our moral systems and our economic systems are able to deal with them. We're going to have to look past some of these really almost insuperable difficulties and focus on things that are relatively simple in order to reduce the warming and to allow us to adapt.
And as you say, there's no one perfect solution. There's no superhero waiting in the wings to save us. Is that part of what's made it difficult for us to tackle this?
That's right. We keep waiting for the adult in the room to come and fix everything or make it better. We think that simply scapegoating one part of the world, China, or one part of society, corporations, that somehow that's going to, you know, let us go into an us versus them thing that's going to work. But it's not like that. It's that humanity as a collective is going to have to get off of fossil fuels and find another way of organizing the global economy.
And it's clear from what you're saying, although you write that our effort to prevent climate change has failed, that's not an excuse to give up now.
That's right. There's at least three reasons for that. The first is the degree of the warming matters. If we have a 2-degree warming, 3-degree warming, 4-degree warming, all of those little numbers represent vastly greater levels of destruction and much greater risks in terms of catastrophic climate change. Secondly, the rate of the warming matters. We're much better at adjusting to a relatively slow warming than a very rapid warming, although the warming we're experiencing is going to be rapid by any standards. But thirdly, climate change is also going to reshape the way that we live, the kinds of things we do in terms of outdoor activities, where we take our children, the kinds of stories that we tell. And we're going to have to find new ways of meaning and new ways of telling those stories. And so there's a lot for us to do to slow down the warming, to limit its extent, and to figure out how to live in this new world we're creating.
Are we starting to turn from prevention to adaptation to, as you say, figure out how we're going to live in this changed world?
We're starting that turn. we're turning more slowly than I wish we would. And the other concern that I have is that a turn towards adaptation can actually make us too focused on ourselves. I mean, I live in New York. I lived through Hurricane Sandy. There's a high level of consciousness here now about storm surges and about the new normal and the superstorms and so on. But what there isn't a lot of consciousness of is it's not just New Yorkers that are going to be experiencing these things, not just Americans, but people in Mumbai, people in Karachi, people in Alexandria, people all over the world, including people who have emitted much less carbon than Americans have.
And that's part of the problem. You say sometimes the biggest harm will be in the places where the biggest responsibility isn't. The people emitting aren't the ones who will suffer the most.
That's right. So we need not only to adapt, but we also need to adapt our sense of empathy. And when we experience these impacts of climate change, we also have to understand that others are experiencing them, who have less resources in many cases than we do and have done less to cause it. So there's no way of getting around the fact that we need a kind of globalization of consciousness that begins to match the kind of globalization of capital and of our economic system that we've seen develop over the last half century.
Where does that start? Where does that come from?
Well, it starts probably with taking responsibility for our own actions as individuals and recognizing that when we consume something, when we choose to drive instead of bike, for example, or walk, that we're really taking on this responsibility for where these fossil fuels come from, where they go, and so on. But it also, I think, involves changing the way that we think about our political choices and our choices as citizens as well.
You've also mentioned the role of the media in covering or maybe miscovering climate change. What do you think the media has done wrong? What would you like to see them, or I guess us, I'm part of it, do better?
Well, Rob, I'm holding you personally responsible for this, of course. No, I think there's two areas where the media have been quite unhelpful. One is in treating this as a kind of political story where it's one side against the other and one team has their facts and the other team has their facts. You know, the atmosphere is not a member of any political party. And no matter how much we talk about this, that, and the other thing, the greenhouse gases continue to reach the atmosphere and to change the climate. There's plenty of room to argue about what policy choices we should take in response to this problem. But there's really no reason to be arguing with the basic facts of the science. And the media too often has sort of treated this like a team sport. Here's the climate, people who believe in climate change, the people who don't believe in climate change. That's really not the way to talk about science. The second problem, I think, is that it's a very difficult issue. It's a very confusing issue. And climate is actually an aspect of every other issue. So my favorite example of misservice that the media often performs is from my local hometown newspaper, the New York Times, where you can read, on the front page of the newspaper that climate change is a terrible problem, no one's doing anything about it. And then you can read in the business section about how the price of oil is skyrocketing and what a terrible thing this is. You've got to put those two things together. Climate change is related to our meat consumption, to our energy consumption, to all of these things. And we really can't just say, it's great when fossil fuels prices are cheap, but climate change is terrible. You've got to put those two thoughts together if you really want to educate your readers.
Do you see positive signs of change, whether at the policy level or at the people level?
Well, the biggest change is that from 1992 to 2009, all eyes of the world were on the global negotiations to try to bring climate change under control. Those negotiations essentially collapsed in 2009, though diplomats continued to fly around the world doing what diplomats do. And the action has really turned to towns, cities, regions, countries, and the national politics or the local politics in those places. And we're seeing a lot of action in the United States, in states and localities, but we're also seeing lots of action in other countries around the world as well. None of this action is enough. We're going to suffer. It's going to be a wild ride. But nevertheless, things are happening, and things are beginning to move. We still need national action. The Obama administration has done pretty much what it can in terms of executive orders, but we need national legislation. We need to put a price on carbon. There won't really be any substitute for that.
Are you optimistic that something like that could happen? I know you've been working on this book for about 25 years. Is that going to happen in the next 25 years?
Well, you know, think like an optimist, live like a pessimist. It can happen. Will it happen? I don't know. But I know that every day when I get up in the morning, something good can happen. Some of it is just simply reducing meat consumption. Some of it is knowing that decisions are being made to regulate coal-fired power plants, for example, that hadn't been done in the past. So there's plenty of good things that can be done and will be done every day. There's plenty of good projects for us all to work on as individuals and in communities. So that gives me optimism. And humanity, at the end of the day, what makes us special, if anything, is that we're an extremely adaptable species. And we will adapt. Life will go on. Much will be lost. People will suffer. But there are things we can do to make it better.
Dale, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That was Dale Jamieson. He's professor of environmental studies and philosophy at New York University. His new book is Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future.